It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Coming up on episode number 128 of Sports Day Plus. At 6:30, I'm spending a couple of segments with comedian Mike Vecchione prior to his headlining shows at the Comedy Mothership this weekend. And a mere seconds, I'm chatting with award-winning actor and filmmaker Viggo Mortensen about a new Western that he wrote, directed, and starred in. I am your host, Trey Elling. You can give me a follow on Twitter at Courtesy Wave and do the same for ESPN Austin at 1027 ESPN. Viggo Mortensen is a longtime actor and filmmaker who has been nominated for 3 Academy Awards for Best Actor, 3 BAFTA Awards, 4 Golden Globes, and an Independent Spirit Award. His list of credits include the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Captain Fantastic, The Road, Green Book, and much, much more. And as of today, he's got a new film out in theaters, the second film that he has not only starred in, but also written, directed, and composed the music for. It's Viggo's take on the Western genre. The title is The Dead Don't Hurt. As I mentioned, it's out in theaters as of today. Viggo Mortensen is now nice enough to join me to talk about the film and more. Viggo, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Trey. How are you?
I am great. Thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed this movie, as plenty of other people have described it, although it's hard to fit this film into a box. It is a bit of a Western and also a love story centered around a female character. Some have called it a feminist Western. It is inspired by your own mother, though, in terms of the genesis of you creating this story. How is it initially inspired by your own mom?
Well, she wasn't someone on the Western frontier, obviously. I'm not that old.
Yeah.
But no, in terms of the character, the personality of our lead, Vivian, my mother had that kind of personality. She was, you know, like Vivian, a woman of her time, you know, mother, housewife, mother of 3 boys. But she was very independent in her thinking. And as much as was possible, owing to the limitations of the time she lived in, free in her movement, you know, very strong willed person, stubborn in a way, curious about the world, and didn't put limitations on herself in terms of the opinions she had about things and her curiosity about the world and about people. And so that was sort of the model in terms of the type of woman I wanted to tell the story about. And I putting her in a Western setting in that historical period, to me, just I thought it gave more, rather than say now or even in the 20th century, more obstacles, you know, because that's a society at the time, the Western frontier, small town, kind of a lawless place where the society was dominated by men generally, but specifically by a couple powerful, unscrupulous men who were not averse to using violence to achieve what they wanted.
That's right. It's the type of place where you get people's attention by firing a gun a couple of times, even if you are inside the saloon.
Exactly. Exactly. And I thought that would create more obstacles for her to be how she is.
Yeah, and Vivian is played so well by Vicky Creeps, who has obviously received a ton of recognition for her portrayal of Vivian. You actually sought her out to play this role. What did you see in Vicky that made you think that she would do so well in this capacity?
Well, when I finished writing the script, I had seen, the first thing I remember seeing her in was The Phantom Thread. And she just had an incredible screen presence, very strong presence. She seemed to transmit her thoughts and feelings almost like through her skin. You know, it's one of those things that are kind of mysterious about movies. You know, you can take an actor who's great on stage, who's you know, really great actor or actress. And then in front of the camera, they may be really right for the character and they do a great job. But then there are some people that have something extra. They have a presence. They have something that the camera seems to almost drawn to, right? And that we recognize as audience members. There's something extra, something special that they have on screen. And even in silent moments, and since this was a character that transmits a lot even between the words, you know, I was looking for someone that could, that had that quality, and I could think of no one better than her. But you never know, you know, if someone's going to be available, if they're going to even like the story or the character. Fortunately, she read it right away and said yes right away, which made us all, you know, the whole team really hopeful. It's like, okay, now there isn't like a limit to what we can do. It's up to us now to surround her with good actors and to tell the story well, you know. But we do have a chance now that she said yes to playing Vivian. We have a chance to make a good movie with a strong woman at the center of the story.
In an interview that you and Vicky did together, I think it was at TIFF, she said that acting is playing. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Totally. Yeah. If you're not playing and you're not having some fun, then I don't know why you're doing it. But personally, I agree with that. It's really important to be as prepared as you can be as a team and know what you're going to shoot, know how you're going to approach telling the story because you have a limited time to do it, limited budget. But then to keep an open mind to what the crew and the cast of actors, their ideas, their input, because a good idea can come from anywhere. And sometimes someone has a take on a line reading, or a way to compose a shot that's better than what you had planned to do. And it's, you got one shot to tell the story as best you can, and it's much better to do it as a team. That's what I've learned from the good directors and actors.
Yeah, I love to hear you talking about the importance of the collaborative process. You obviously wear a ton of hats in this film. You write it, you direct it, you act in it. You're one of the co-stars. You actually compose the music for this film too. But you talk about the collaborative process being key and this story being told correctly. Is that partially the result of you also working with rigid filmmakers who weren't willing to collaborate and therefore the project ends up suffering as a result?
Well, that's a good point. And I think that as much as I can say that I've been extremely fortunate over several decades to work for really talented women and men, you know, directors, cinematographers, producers, screenwriters, good storytellers, and learned how to prepare things well and how to collaborate well, I've learned probably just as much, or in some cases more, from the few instances where I have seen people not work in the most efficient way. In other words, not listening, being, as you say, rigid, you know, like not. And sometimes those people make good movies, you know, like that. No, it's my way or the highway, and I don't want you to change the line. I don't want to do a different shot. This is the way I'm doing it. This is the way I always pictured it. And I'm sticking to my guns. And sometimes they make really good movies that way. But I'm convinced, although I can't prove it, obviously, but I'm convinced that those movies would have been even better if they'd been more open to the collaborative aspect of filmmaking. And I think they would have had more fun, personally. I mean, it is play, you know, and it's serious play, but it's still play. And it's good to have a laugh, and it's good to be honest when you don't have the answers. For an actor or for a crew member, okay, well, let's try to work it out. That's a good question. I don't know how we're going to do this, or I have a very good idea about how to do this, but if you disagree, tell me why.
Yeah, the process can involve hard work, should involve hard work, but it can also be very enjoyable too. Those things are not mutually exclusive. He is actor and filmmaker Viggo Mortensen joining me for the first couple of segments of today's show, talking about his excellent new film, The Dead Don't Hurt. It is out in theaters as of today. Coming up, we continue the conversation with Viggo Mortensen right here on Sports Day Plus on 102.7 ESPN and 1027ESPN.com.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Back with actor and filmmaker Viggo Mortensen talking about his new film, The Dead Don't Hurt, that he wrote, directed, starred in, and composed the music for. It's a unique take on the Western genre that is out in theaters as of today. Now, Viggo, this story was told in a non-linear structure, which you said is all about finding the rhythm, which is very similar to editing music, which was an interesting comment to me. How so?
Well, like when you're editing music, which is something I had experience with before directing my first movie, Falling, although I had not edited images, when I got into the editing room and we started working on that, I realized that there was something similar with music, you know, what the levels are in terms of volume and how many notes tell a certain part of that story of that song or that piece of music. If you listen enough, it'll tell you what needs to be there and what you can lose, what you can cut away. You know, how much can you take out of a melody and still have the melody be there and work? Same with a poem, let's say. You know, how many words can you take out and still get the idea across? And same goes with storytelling in the movies. I think it's just as important many times what you don't show and what isn't said in a movie that gets something across to the audience, allows them to think for themselves, you know. And I think some filmmakers don't trust the audience, or maybe it's because when the budgets are really big, they're like, oh, we got to really make everything clear, and we got to have a voiceover to explain this, and the dialogue has to explain this, and the music has to tell them that they have to be afraid or be happy or be whatever. And I'm not a fan, just as an audience member. I don't like movies where they underestimate my intelligence, basically, and have spoon feed me everything. And so I made the kind of movie I wanted to see, you know, that I like in both cases so far. A movie where hopefully there's enough happening in the first 10, 15 minutes that's interesting or attractive enough that I get involved as an audience member, and then I have the pieces to put together and then begin to participate in a way almost as a storyteller myself, as an audience. Like the director is respecting my ability to put it together for myself and draw my own conclusions. You know, that's why I like Q&A sessions, you know, the question answer sessions after screenings with the audiences, which I've done quite a few already for this movie in different places, different cultures. And first of all, it's really encouraging when they stay at the end of the movie, they haven't left.
Yeah.
And then they have lots of questions, like too many, more than you can answer. It just means something has worked. They've connected. They've made the story their own. And sometimes their comments are surprising. Like, well, I never thought of it in that way. Or, no, I wasn't conscious of trying to say that. But if you feel that way, well, it's valid. It's your movie now, you know. So have at it.
Yeah, that's hard for young storytellers to understand the idea behind not giving every mundane piece of information and letting the audience come to their own conclusions. And typically it's the right conclusion, but with art, it is very subjective as well. So I love to hear you really expressing that and talking about that. Now, there are certain details that you made sure to get right, though, in this film. One, I love the sweeping vistas that were throughout this movie. Kudos, I guess, to Durango, Mexico for that one. But you also wanted to make sure to get the horseback riding correct, too. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I grew up with horses, so that was an advantage. I've started riding when I was 3 or 4, and I've always liked being around horses. And when I've watched Westerns, even from when I was a little kid, even in some of the better Westerns, every once in a while, there's an actor that I can tell, as someone who knows horses, they're not that comfortable around the animal, or it's even the way they walk up to it, or the way they get on and off, or they try to be too flashy, or it's just not, it's not believable. And I've always thought when I watch Westerns, well, horses were the mode of transport, whether it was with wagons or riding them, you know, unless you were taking a train somewhere, that's it, you know. And if you're not comfortable around horses as an adult, in the West, it's, unless you're living in San Francisco or something, it's looks odd to me, you know, when you see cowboys that don't ride that well, you know, and you do see that in movies sometimes, and maybe people don't notice it that much, but we were very careful with that and tried to make sure that the horsemanship was right, and just, you know, the look of the riding, the look of the horsemen, and yeah, and even Vicky, and unfortunately she knew how to ride before we did this movie, so she looks right at ease on the horse, which was helpful. And yeah, that was important.
Yeah, I think just it's very similar to an actor getting cast in a sports movie, let's say, but it's very clear whenever they pick up a ball that they've never done so before, and that just completely shatters the believability of it all.
Yeah, it ruins it for you. You kind of want to go with it if you like the story, but you kind of, in the back of your mind, you're like, yeah, he's not a baseball pitcher or, you know, whatever. And yeah, it's the same thing. But it was as important to get those aspects of the riding and as it was to get the saddles right and the lamps and the saloon and the clothes and the language, too. The way people spoke back then is a little different from now. And not every character spoke the same way, whether it's the mayor, Schiller, he's probably the most verbose. And he has a certain, you can probably feel from the way he talks, he's probably the only person in the region that's, you know, has a law degree or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, Weston's father, played by Garrett Dillahunt, you know, he's a man of few words. He's more of a man of action. He has certain impatience for people who talk a lot and who talk in a refined way. So you see that right away in the encounter, you know, that dialogue in the bank between the mayor and Garrett's character. And I like those details and turns of phrase that different people had. And then, you know, to have the two leads, the main lead being Vivian and then Olsen, not be Anglo-Saxons, you know, mm-hmm. not have English as their first language, that's kind of reflective of the way society was back then, even just as much as now in a way, unless you were Native American, you know, you came from all kinds of places, and it was important. That was another historical detail I wanted to get right, is you not just have some Chinese people or Mexican people in the background, but have people from different cultures and with different languages and accents and vocabularies thrown in there. It feels more realistic in terms of the time period.
I love that detail, but I also loved how the first time your character asks Vivian where she's from, she says America, because ultimately, even if they're not necessarily from the U.S., they are still pursuing that American dream back in the 1800s too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and she's from, literally, she's from the Northeast, right on the border with Canada, and they're a French-speaking family. You know, you see that in the flashback scenes of her childhood. And that's what they speak at home, but they're no less American than Alfred Jeffries is, you know. It's like it's a country that's made up of lots of different kinds of people. And so she throws that back at him. Yeah, I am. I am American. He's like, well, you don't sound like it. And it's like, that's his limitation. It's like, well, the Americans sound like, as they do today, they have all kinds of accents and they're from all kinds of places. People even that were born in the United States. So.
Yep. So I think for a lot of us, each new experience is hopefully a learning experience, Viggo. Considering that this was a new experience for you, not your first time to necessarily do all these things, but to do so in telling this story, what did you learn from getting to make The Dead Don't Hurt?
I guess cautiously, I learned to be just trust my judgment after taking in everybody else's point of view. If I feel really strongly, these are the shots I want today, and I don't need a close-up, for example, or I don't want to do another angle on the scene. I feel like I've got what I need in the editing room to trust that a little bit more, you know, and that just comes from experience and doing it, I think. You know, over decades, I've learned from really good filmmakers and storytellers, so I've taken that in and tried to make the most of it. And each story is different, just like every actor is different. And the best thing you can do is be flexible and open-minded, because you can't treat every actor the same way as a director. You're not going to get the same result. You have to just adapt to the day, adapt to how they feel, adapt to their strengths, and try to find the best way to put them at ease and work well as a team, you know. And I don't know what the next one will be like. It'll be a different kind of story. I also learned making The Dead Don't Hurt that it just reconfirmed I like the Western genre, and hopefully I'll get to make another one.
And last question now, what do you love about filmmaking?
I like the team aspect of it. I mean, it's a very complete universe in terms of creative exploration, all kinds of skills, you know, from different kinds of people, craftsmanship, artistry, you know, it's a very complete artistic universe. But the best thing of all is that it's a collaborative effort, and you're always going to make a better movie if you rely on your team and make them feel valued, and they're not just their technical skills important as actors or crew members, but that their personal involvement in the storytelling is valued as well. And it creates a bond right from the beginning, and it's not just another shoot. It's not just another movie, not just another job. It's a special, unique, one-off opportunity to tell a particular kind of story together.
Beautifully put. He is Viggo Mortensen, the writer, director, star, and composer of The Dead Don't Hurt. It actually opens in theaters today, May 31st, and it is one of those films that you do want to see in the theaters if you can. Viggo, real honor and a pleasure getting to speak with you today. Thank you so much for the time.
Likewise. Thank you for your time.
Coming up, I continue a guest-heavy Sports Day Plus on this Friday with comedian Mike Vecchione. He is headlining at Joe Rogan's Comedy Mothership this weekend. Prior to that, he joins me to talk comedy and life here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Mike Vecchione is a longtime stand-up comedian who's bringing that craft to Austin this weekend, headlining Joe Rogan's Comedy Mothership for a second time. Now, tickets are all sold out this weekend, but I do recommend you check out his work, either through his website, mikevecchione.com, or more simply, if you're having a hard time spelling that last name, you can find him on social media at Comic Mike V. Mike, thank you so much for the time. How you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Congratulations on, I guess, trip number two to headline at the Comedy Mothership.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Rave reviews since opening a little bit more than a year ago. What was your first experience like here in Austin, opening at Joe or headlining at Joe Rogan's place?
It was unreal. It was packed. It was pretty nuts, man. It's like the perfect club. He designed. You could tell it was designed by a comic, like every like little thing that we think of, it's like he's got it. You know what I mean? It's like down to the light in the green room when the previous comic is lit, that light goes off. So it's like you can know that he's lit in the green room without somebody telling you. The other thing is that the check drop, there's only a few clubs. I don't know why more clubs do it, don't do it, but to check drop after the set is over, drop checks afterwards. The clubs that I know that do it, they either stamp the receipt or give the customer a ticket, and they put somebody by the door and they just have to check it and to make sure they paid, and then they leave. And it's like, it's not annoying for the comic to have to fight the check drop, which we all have to do in other clubs. I don't know why more clubs don't do it.
You're a New York City guy, right?
Yeah, I'm here now.
Where did you start out?
Started in Philadelphia.
Another Philly guy. Man, some cold-blooded murderers come from that city, don't they?
It's a good place. Back when I started, it was not that many clubs. It was the Laugh House where I started from, which is where Kevin Hart came from, Big J, Kurt Metzger. Like, those three guys were like the class before me, and they started coming to New York before I even got there. And then me and Joe DeRosa were around doing open mics and Thursday nights around the same time, hosting and doing, you know, started featuring. And then Joe moved in with Jay up here. And then he came back to the club one weekend. He's like, what are you still doing? Because I was getting better. He's like, what are you still doing here? Move. You got to move. That was the advice back then. It's like you do your little 3 years or 3.5 years. You move as far as you can in the club in your city. And then you move to New York or L.A.
How big of an adjustment was that for you?
I think Jay and some of these other guys, they like did trips from Philly to try to get on in New York and then came home. They went up and crashed on couches and then came home, you know, whatever. I didn't do any of that. I was like, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm just going to do it. And then whatever happens, happens. If I bottom out and nothing, I'll just be in New York. What's bad about that? I'll just be in New York. I'll live in New York and I'll get a job and I'll do something in New York. It's a great place. So that was my thinking going in. I'm like, if I fail, I'll just, worst case scenario, I'll be in New York.
Did you have a backup plan in terms of a profession?
I was a teacher before.
Okay.
I didn't start till I was 28. I'm 51 now. So I was a teacher and I was finishing up my master's. I had gone through a bad breakup. And I was finishing my master's and I remember thinking, wow, I gotta like figure something else out with my time. So I started going to open mics. I started hitting open mics and at first I wasn't funny. And I was like, well, this is gonna help me public speaking wise. It's gonna help me in some capacity. So I'm just gonna keep doing it. And it's a thing too, when you go through a bad breakup or a bad time in your life where you're like, I just kind of don't care what people think. I just don't care. Like you kind of have a thing where it's like, I don't even care. You lose a little bit of that, not self-awareness, but like pride or whatever it is that keeps you from doing fearful things. So I just kept doing it. And then about three and a half years in, I started getting consistently good. I started doing consistently well. So I was like, wow, maybe there's something here. And then I was 31 at the time, my life circumstances, I was alone. Didn't care for the job that I was in, was going to make a move that way. And I was like, why don't I just make the move? This is the time to do it. If you have a family of kids, you have to go about it differently. But I was like, no family of my own. I have an opportunity here and I can always go back to teaching if I really want to. And let me take a calculated risk. So that's what I did.
Was there something epiphanous or revelatory that helped you to become more consistently funny after those 3 years? Or was it just merely a matter of you continuing not to care?
You don't care and you stay consistent with it. It's like, oh, I bombed tonight. And the instinct is like, I don't want to go up again. Like, forget this. Maybe I'm just not good at this. I just kind of stayed in the cut. Like, I don't care if I'm not good at this. Maybe I'm not going to be a big stand-up star. Like, I'm just going to keep doing this and it'll help me with public speaking. If nothing, at the very least, it'll help me with public speaking. But I did enjoy doing it. So I would prepare for my sets every night. And then if I failed or whatever didn't work, I would just like, okay, I scrapped those jokes. And then the through line is like getting better on stage, also feeling more comfortable, feeling like yourself, handling different situations. Like, this is good for me in some way. Maybe I'm not going to be a big star, but like, this is good for me in some capacity. I'm overcoming a fear. I'm learning a skill. These are good things. And maybe this will help me down the road with education, because I was really committed to like education. So it's like, maybe this will help me.
The whole idea of pursuing your dreams and why it's good for you, it's not even necessarily always good for you.
Right.
Because you achieved that dream, although you have achieved that dream. You are a stand-up comedian and nothing else now, so congratulations on that. But pursuing those dreams can help you to realize other dreams at the same time, too. And maybe early on, as you were trying to really find your footing and find your voice, the fact that you were putting yourself through something hard and overcoming that fear, and you were able to rationalize it because there was a relation to your job as a teacher, it just helped to fuel you. So kudos to you for having a healthy mindset early on and getting to that ultimate mountaintop, I guess. Now, what kind of teacher were you before you ultimately quit the profession?
I was a special education teacher.
Oh, wow.
With emotional and behavioral problems. And I taught middle school mostly, but then in the end, I taught high school. First year I was there, I did really well with the kids. They were tough. But I brought a new program in, worked the program, and a couple kids really bought in, and I ended up having a very good relationship with them. Even after post-graduation, we stayed friends. They were very appreciative. But the next class coming up, fought the system a little bit and fought me, really fought me on it. And as a result, like the administration kind of came down on me a little bit. And I, at the end of the year, they're like, we have to like talk and you have to start doing things the way we want you to do it. I go, that's just, I didn't agree with them that they were doing the right things. So, you know, it was kind of like a reprimand situation. And I just was like, you don't have to reprimand me. I'll just resign. So I ended up resigning, and then everything kind of like, you know, you're looking back on it, everything kind of like fell into place where it's like, I resigned, I moved, and I came up here to like, to try stand up. Oh, really give man. It, I mean, really try, you know.
Dude, that is crazy. I was going to congratulate you for dodging what the school system has become over the last 4 to 5 years now with how COVID broke everybody.
I mean, I was just watching today. They have a whole thing on YouTube about why I quit teaching. And these teachers are on there. And it's like, what they're saying was the tip of the iceberg that I saw where parents, you know, it was a wealthier district, but like different districts have different challenges, you know, socioeconomically. And it was a wealthier district. And the parents really put pressure on the administrators, and the administrators were like, we're very much like, we can't get sued. We have to like, you know, kind of like do what the parents are saying. And I'm like, well, then why did I get a master's in this? I don't, you know, why did I go to college for this and get all these degrees and stuff if they're just going to come in and muscle us? And I was listening to it today. It's like, that was the tip of the iceberg with what happened. And I have to say this, this is very ironic, funny. I just did a show in Delaware about a month ago, and it was close to the where I taught in Pennsylvania, 20 minutes away. All the kids that I taught 20 years later showed up. They showed up, they got a table, and they watched my set. And the first thing I said out of the gates of my set, it's like, I was a teacher here. I taught this group of kids at this table. And I have to tell you, I'm couldn't be more pleased. They were trying to get out of my class the entire year. And now they each paid $35 for a ticket to come and see me. That makes me the happiest I've ever been, knowing that they had to pay $35 when they were trying to get out of my class for a full year. So yeah, it really made me laugh. It made them laugh. I talked to all of them. Some of their parents were there, administrators were there, and it was all good.
That's,
you know,
so cool.
The kids were saying, the kids who gave me the hardest time were saying, and they were there and they said, we're glad you got out. We're glad you got out. We hated, like, I'm sorry for what I did. I'm sorry for the trouble we caused you, but I'm glad that you are doing something else. It was literally a month ago. And they, you know, because I've had some kids come to other shows, but I've never had them all together. And some of them I haven't seen since I stopped working there. So they all came together, and most of them, and you know, saw them, got to talk to them, got to see how they were doing. And it was really because a lot of times in life, when you're in something, you can't see the totality of it. You're not at a perspective where you could see the totality of it. So that when after that night, I was like, this is, and I do go to other dates and stuff, but I was like, this is pretty special.
Good Lord, man. Calling that special is maybe an enormous understatement there. That is really cool, and thank you so much for sharing that. He is comedian Mike Vecchione, headlining at Joe Rogan's Comedy Mothership this weekend. Nice enough to join me for a couple of segments prior to that to talk comedy and life. No tickets available at the Mothership this weekend, but I do still recommend you check out a show at comedymothership.com and find Mike on social media at Mike V Comedy. Coming up, one final segment with Mike Vecchione here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Back for one final segment with comedian Mike Vecchione. He's headlining at the Comedy Mothership this weekend. Nice enough to join me for a couple of segments prior to that. His shows this weekend are all sold out. You should still check him out online at Mike V Comedy on social media. And Mike, I don't want to make any assumptions here, but if you're a Philly guy, are you a Philly sports fan too?
Yes, because when I moved, I'm originally from Northeast Ohio, and then I spent half in Youngstown, Ohio, which is a steel town, And then we moved to Florida, Boca Raton, as a family, then back to Ohio and then back to Florida. So I spent half and half the time in Youngstown, Ohio, and half in Florida. And I have great experiences in both places. But then I went to Penn State University, and I moved to Philly with a girl that I was with. She's from that area, and I moved there in 95, 1995. And there was no satellite television, so we lived downtown, and it's like you watch whatever team is on, and it was the Eagles, so I became a huge Eagles fan.
So Philly fans have a reputation. What's the most messed up thing you've ever seen out of Philly fans before?
Yeah, I just remember it being like you can't wear a different jersey in the stadium. I had a friend of mine who was a cop at the time. He's a Pittsburgh, like he's a Steelers fan, but he went to the Eagles game, support, Eagles, whatever. And he went in the bathroom and had like two Eagles fans were beating up a guy who had another jersey on in the state to like pull them off of him. And it's like, I mean, I'm all for spirit and fun and everything, but I mean, when it gets to that point, it's not really even about sports anymore. It's
No.
about something else that's going on inside of you, and you're using that as a mechanism to take out your anger. But yeah, there's some of that. There's some of that with not just Eagles fans, but with football fans in general. But the opposing fans can be antagonistic also. You know what I mean? It's not all one-sided. So it's like, but most of the people, I'd say the overwhelming majority are like good, just good, wanting to have fun people. You get the psychos, and that's what makes the news. But
Gosh, thinking about your time in Happy Valley, you were there during some fruitful times for Joe Pod too, if I'm remembering correctly. Late 80s, early 90s.
I was there the same year. The year I graduated, it was we had three guys go in the first round.
Damn.
We had Kerry Collins, Kijana Carter, and Kyle Brady all went in the first round.
Oh, Kajana was such a good running back. He
So
ended up with the
good. From
Bengals,
Ohio.
right?
So good. And I met him before. My roommate was friends with him. He was
Huh.
a nice guy. He was a great guy. Yeah. But he was I mean, Rashan Salaam.
Rashan Salaam, yeah, from Colorado.
He won the Heisman.
Yep.
But I mean, Kijana was, in my opinion, just no disrespect, God rest his soul, Rashan Salaam. But Kijana was the best. He was unreal. He would just line yards from scrimmage were just insane.
Well, I'm a Longhorns fan, and Rashan Salaam lit us up a couple of years, if I'm remembering correctly. Definitely one year, but he also had Cordell Stewart as his quarterback too. It's not like Kerry Collins, for as good of a thrower as he was that fleet of foot. Kajano was having to do all the work on the ground on his own.
Right. We had a great team. I mean, I think we were number two in Colorado, and that was when the polls were, but it was under we were undefeated, I think. We ended up number two in the rankings.
Do you ever go back to Happy Valley now?
Well, I went back years ago for a show. It was a benefit show at State College Theater. It was great. And then recently, not within the last couple years, Nate Bargatze is a friend of mine, and we came up together, and he's killing it. He's like selling out arenas now, but back then we went and did the Bryce Jordan. I went and did the Bryce Jordan Center with him, and it was fantastic. It's a huge school, but it seems like a small town because I remember all the different spots we used to go to and where I lived and all that stuff. It's fun. It was fun.
Yeah, I've heard Ann Arbor with University of Michigan, of course, is a lot like that too. Where,
Is
yeah,
it?
there's a
I
town.
heard because Ohio State is like, I heard Ohio State is huge. It's just humongous. Like
Yeah.
Happy Valley's not really like that. That's the beauty of it. It's a college town in the middle of nowhere. It's very small.
Yeah, University of Texas is probably more like Ohio State than it is Michigan, because you can be in Austin and not get anywhere near the campus. Now, if you're on a certain highway, you'll see the campus and you'll see the football stadium and whatnot, but Austin has grown so big at this point. I mean, shoot, it used to be the live music capital of the world, and now it's turning into a comedy capital of the world. So there's lots of different worlds that you can choose to reside in if you want to, or none of them at all, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's supposed to be a great place to live. I don't know. The guys rave about it. The guys who've moved there rave about it.
People who have moved here tend to love it. It does have a bit of a small town feel at times too, especially as compared to like a New York or Chicago or something. But again, there's enough going on that I think you could probably separate yourself if you really want to.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I've been downtown, obviously. I've done Joe's Club before, but it's the suburbs. There must be great suburbs out there too, you know?
My family lives in the suburbs. I've got a wife and a 9 and 7 year old. And so we live in Cedar Park. It's a northwest suburb. And it's great because we're close enough to the highway that if we want to go experience a city, food, nightlife, comedy shows, whatever, it's a 20 to 25 minute drive. It's reasonable to drive downtown still, unlike the New Yorks and the Chicagos of the world, San Francisco, something like that. So you can park for a moderate price or you can Uber it down there and you're not going to break the bank doing so. But you also get to escape the BS as well. And you're not having to make like an hour long commute just to do that. So I dig it. I lived in Austin going to school at UT and then living there for a decade, pursuing a career in broadcasting before moving away to Oregon, then Chicago, and then back to Austin now for almost another decade. And it's a very different city than it was when I started living there in the mid 1990s, in a good way though. And people who are longtime Austin people gripe because there are a lot of new faces in the city. Right. There's a lot of new things and there's some cool old stuff that is no longer around as a result of competition, just being priced out, whatever else it is. But that inevitably happens with cool places. They evolve and things change. Things are going to change regardless. But in most cases, I think Austin is changing for the better. Now it is losing a little bit of its weirdness, but that's why it's important for those who live here and move here, recognize the need. And part of the weirdness is embracing the mom and pop culture, but part of it is also a sort of sharing of ideas, right? Where you don't necessarily need to agree with what somebody is saying to have a conversation with them. And it doesn't need to devolve into name calling either. I think that's one of the reasons why, look, Rogan's obviously a big reason here too, but one of the reasons why comedy has taken such a stranglehold over Austin is because Austin is a very open-minded place. It's considered a progressive city, but it's surrounded by conservative Texas. But even though it's a progressive city, it's a progressive city where you get a lot of people coming together for civic debate. And that's something that we lost a few years ago that I do feel like is starting to come back now. And stand-up comedy, one of the big reasons why it is now entering another sort of golden era is because people were craving taboo issues being talked about in a way that wasn't necessarily going to offend everybody. Of course, somebody's going to be offended by certain things, just about anything that you bring up. But when a comedian's doing it right, typically you guys are hitting both sides of an issue. And at the end of the day, we can look at one another, even if we may have a general disagreement over that issue, and just shake our heads and laugh at the absurdity of it all.
Yeah, that's the right thing to do. Because as a comedian, you're up there, regardless of what they're doing, they're doing it to make the crowd laugh.
Yeah.
And I think it loses something, like, especially online. You know, I'll have jokes and we'll all have jokes posted and you'll have people comment and argue the joke. They're arguing the joke like you're giving a speech on a topic. It's like, this is all just fun. And because the thing is, there's a kernel of truth in there.
Yeah.
So it's the internet is the Wild West. So they're just on there and they're going, no, I disagree with this. It's like, you're disagreeing with a joke. You know that, right? It's like, you know, you're taking your time out of your day to write that you've disagreed with this joke. So it's kind of nuts, but at live shows, most people get what you're doing.
There is an adjustment that you guys are having to deal with, though, because social media has made comedians much more popular. But in doing so, there's like an enabling of the rookies who go to a comedy show who think the entire show is about you yelling stuff out to the comedian.
Well, because what they're seeing online is these crowd work clips. And I understand why comics are putting out crowd work clips. Yeah. It's because, you know, they're trying to sell tickets and it's like these clips do very well. But then the lay person goes on and sees the clips and goes, oh, that must be how you act at a comedy club. That must be how it is. So they go there and they do that. They probably had a few drinks and they go do that. And they think in many cases, they think they're helping. But it's like most people have an act when they go up and it's like that is disruptive.
Right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for the time today. People cannot buy tickets to go see you this weekend because Gosh, your shows have been sold out for at least a week, if not more, but I am going to encourage people to go to your website, mikevecchione.com. It's where they can see your latest stand-up special, The Attractives.
Can I plug my social media also?
Oh, please do.
Yeah, it's just Comic Mike V. If you guys go to Comic Mike V, I'm on Instagram, obviously, TikTok, Twitter. I have a long Italian last name that's confusing to people. But Comic Mike V is where you can find me, and I have dates and all that stuff coming up. So Comic Mike V, thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to try and spell your last name off the top of my head because it'll help people get to your website too. V-E-C-C-H-I-O-N-E.
Nailed it. You get a free trip to Naples, Italy.
Mike, congratulations, man, on the success. I love hearing about what happened a month ago and really, really do appreciate the time. Hopefully this isn't the last time you and I get to speak.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
And that is it for another edition of Sports Day Plus. I'll be back on Monday at 6. That includes a recap of my week-long vacation in Chicago. Yes, drink up. In the meantime, thank you so much for tuning in to today's show. Have yourselves a fantastic weekend and hook 'em.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elliott.